The conference will include lectures, an awards banquet, a speaker's cocktail party, and, oh yes, a special luncheon presentation with yours truly. Come learn why, when it comes to UFOs, it's no longer just about lights in the sky. It's about lies on the ground. The National Press Club is just two blocks from Metro Center, and there are two dozen hotels nearby. The event website, x-conference.com. That's x-conference.com, or call the Paradigm Research Group, 202-215-8344.
Good evening, welcome to this week's worldwide broadcast of the Joyner Report. Now here's your host, Angela Joyner.
Hi, everyone, and welcome, and thanks for tuning in to tonight's Joyner Report. You're listening to WPRN-FM New Orleans and UFO Paranormal Radio Network.com. Before I bring on tonight's guest, the lovely Nancy Talbot, and we discuss her latest crop circle research, as well as some never-before-released information regarding the Travis Walton investigation, I have a few comments. First of all, I'd like to wish Steve Bassett much success this weekend with his annual X conference in its new venue at the National Press Club. It's my understanding that Steve is short of reaching his break-even goal on the event, and I truly hope that changes. The conference is being live-streamed this year, and details can be found at ParadigmResearchGroup.com. I believe the charge is $24.95. And it gives you access to the whole conference, plus it's going to be archived for 2 weeks. So if you can't make it to the conference, maybe you can get the live stream. Steve's very excited about this and thinks it's going to be the way to go, you know, in the future, that this is really going to be spreading rapidly as to how we get our news and see things, and I think he may be right. Now, for those of you who listened last week regarding my concerns about Texas MUFON, I did extend an invitation to Steve Hudgens to come on the show at his convenience. I told him he had an open invitation, and he has declined. And today, I also extended an invitation to William Puckett to address his concerns, or what I keep hearing are his concerns, regarding the Powell Schultz radar report. And he graciously and promptly replied, and I'd like to take a minute to read this to you. I don't think he'll mind. It's a really nice little note. It says, "Angela, I don't believe that I ever thought that the Powell Schultz January 2008 radar analysis was flawed. I believe that I indicated a few errors in the report that were later corrected. My presentation at the MUFON conference, brief as it was," and this is my words, I believe he is referring to the San Jose MUFON symposium, that he said explained his conclusions. "I looked at some other data," and he explains that data was Doppler radar, meteorological data, "and did an analysis of atmospheric radar refractivity potential, which would indicate if the atmosphere had the potential to produce anomalous propagation." And he doesn't really say what that conclusion was, but he says, "I know that Mr. Schultz was there to hear my presentation, and my slides were updated on the MUFON website. I never produced any formal report beyond the PowerPoint. I provided some other support to the History Channel and Ken Cherry with respect to the January 2008 Stephenville sightings. And I think he's referring to the UFO hunters, which I believe Ken Cherry and none of the major witnesses went on that show because we were concerned about that UFO hunters bit. It says, "My October 2008 Stephenville analysis was performed at the request of James Carrion and Ken Cherry. I wrote a report for the MUFON Journal and did a video presentation for Ken Cherry, which I assume you and or Powell/Schultz attended." Well, no, we didn't attend. We didn't get the invitation. "I do decline any invitation to discuss my analysis on any program. I am quite busy investigating other UFO cases, including radar analysis. I consider my work on the Stephenville analysis complete. My intention is to find the truth behind the UFO phenomenon. I always try to work cooperatively with other investigators when possible. Well, gee, what a nice response, and I'm hoping he's going to change his mind and come on later when maybe he's not quite as busy. So we'll see how that goes. But I was hearing from some Texas MUFON people that Mr. Puckett had concerns and believed the conclusions were wrong in the Stephenville radar report put together by Robert Powell and Glenn Schultz, and this pretty well tells me that that was not the case. He might have found a few little errors or something, and Robert and Glenn will be able to clue us in on that. I don't know, but there wasn't anything major he found wrong with it. And so far, that report has stood up for 2 years. So I still think it's one that's historical for ufology. Well, enough of that, and tonight, let's get on to our guest, as I said, the charming Nancy Talbot. Most of you are familiar with Nancy's strong research in crop circles. She's president of the BLT Research Team Incorporated, which is composed of several hundred trained field sampling personnel in the U.S., Canada, and Europe. They collect plant and soil samples at crop circle sites for analyses by a number of scientists in various disciplines. This is a return visit to the Joyner Report, and later, as I said, Nancy will reveal some never-before-released information found during her investigations of the Travis Walton case. Welcome back, Nancy.
Well, thank you so much. How are you tonight?
Well, I'm good. I'm a little tired for some reason, but I'm hanging in there. What about you?
About the same. I just, this business never, you know, when you think of the number of times you've heard people, the debunker type, say that they want evidence, and then you think of all the evidence that there is and how much people are scrambling around trying to cover as much as they can. I mean, I agree with you about that radar report. I thought that one done by Powell and whoever the other person was, I thought they did a super good job. But I think it's, you know, there's tons of evidence. There aren't quite enough of us to keep up with it all. And so you get tired sometimes. Angela, you there?
Sorry. Yes, you do get tired, and there's so much, in my opinion, in this field, it's he said, not he said, she said. And, you know, there's not very many women in the field, what I've noticed is there's a whole lot of ego in the field, and it really gets in the way and trips us up.
Well, now, how in the world have you ever noticed that? A healthy ego is obviously required to survive in life, but there is a point where it kind of like a brick wall gets in front of you. I'm afraid I see a bit of that. Of course, you see it everywhere, but in an area like anomalous research, it really causes more troubles than it does good, I think.
Yeah, I do too. Well, let's talk about your new report on BLTResearch.com and the 2009 crop circles. And do you think we should encourage people to go to your website so they can see these photos?
Oh, yeah. If they can see the illustrations, it's going to make it much easier. So it's BLTResearch.com, BLT just like the sandwich. And at the top of the homepage, there's a button or new that says new, going around, and next to it, it's the 2009 UK, that's England, crop circle report. And if you open it up and then follow along with the pictures, it'll help a lot. There were several. That report, we did it for a number of reasons. One is that we haven't put out something about the plants in England in particular for a while. And I was curious to know if the plant changes that we, the visible plant changes that we had documented back in the 90s were still happening. of the changes that occur to the plants and the soils, some of them are not visible. They require the use of a microscope, or they require germination studies, you know, where you germinate the seeds, which obviously takes weeks. There are other tests that have to be done only in the laboratory, but there are four basic visible plant signs, things you can see with your eyes. And what I was trying to do was to help people understand those four things, because the crop circle season has just started again. Just had two of them have just occurred in Italy, and now there's a first one in England. And I wanted people to have this fresh in their minds as they go out to look at crop circles this season. And it was interesting for a number. Go ahead. What?
This Phoenix circle is really quite beautiful.
Well, there were three major results of this work that we did in 2009, as far as I'm concerned. One has to do with that Phoenix. There were a number of circles last summer that were what I'm calling pictorial, meaning that they look like something that you actually would that you'd recognize.
Mm-hmm.
There was that Phoenix one that everybody immediately recognized it as a Phoenix. There were birds. There was a dragonfly. There were a jellyfish. I remember that. There were a bunch of them that clearly looked like something, and everybody pretty much could agree on what they looked like. And that's something new. We haven't seen that before. It only very occasionally in years gone by did a crop circle look like something that you absolutely understood what it was.
Right.
And so I was curious, you know, is it possible that these things that look like something, that they're showing the same plant changes that we found in the genuine circles years ago? Well, it turns out, of course, that we did find, at least in some of them, that these same basic plant changes were occurring in these things that looked like something, the Phoenix being one of the main ones. The second major finding, to my mind, last year was that there have been occasions in the past, and you'll see this as you read through the report, I think it's in the second or third part, where a circle has come down, and there's some farmers in England that I guess are getting pretty tired of this, and the farmer will cut the circle out right away, like that first morning. Sometimes before people had a chance to even get in and look at it, the farmer comes along with his tractor and cuts it out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, when they do that, you can set that blade, the cutter blade, at any height you want, and they tend to only lop off the top part of the plants. It pretty much messes up the design, and that's all they're really trying to do. Well, this last season, not only did this happen where several got cut out right away, it also happened that another formation would come down in that same field the very next night, or within a couple of nights, and be either right next to where the original thing had been, or, you know, 50 yards away, 100 yards away, or in the field right next. And I was real curious to know what was the likelihood that the one that was cut out was real, and then what was the likelihood of the one that came back real? Because that would suggest to me that whatever is doing this is getting a little bit more assertive in having its presence seen.
Okay.
In other words, nope, I'm not going to let you cut that out, and boom, there's going to be another one. Well, it happened that our field worker over there, he happened to get there to one of these things when the second one had just gone down that morning. And he was a real smart guy, and he went into the second one and found all these signs which I have listed there. This apical node elongation, that's the top node, you know, the first one beneath seed head. And those nodes were real elongated. Then he found the expulsion cavities, the holes, blown out farther down the plant stem, they were all there also in the second and third nodes, I think. And he found this throughout that second formation. Then he walked up the tractor lines to get to the first one, the one that had been cut out already.
Mm-hmm.
And in that one, all that was left to look at were the bottom two nodes because the farmer had lopped off the tops. But there were expulsion cavities all over the place in those lower two nodes, which is a real strong, you know, sign. Then he did the smartest thing. He started looking at the standing crop in between those two circles. They were about 50 yards apart, I think. Mm-hmm. And he just walked up and down and was looking at all the standing crop. And darned if he didn't find, and realize this is all an immediate thing. These things have not been sitting in the field. They have heard. And he finds this elongated apical node again in the standing plants and the expulsion cavities, both of which are very good signs of the presence of, you know, this discharge of a plasma, the presence of microwave radiation.
Now, because you're not going to find the expulsion cavities in man-made, human-made, walk-the-plank type things, right?
No, it is possible, and we're doing a much more detailed examination of this coming year because people get a little bit unclear about this. We have seen expulsion cavities occasionally in plants that border the tram lines, the tractor lines. We have seen them occasionally in these turnaround places at the edges of fields where the tractors turn around several times, you know, to go up and down the rows. And we've seen them occasionally in there. And very, very occasionally they have been seen in these tractor line areas in fields where there isn't a circle, where it's just, you know, as far as we know, a virgin field. Now, if the microwave radiation is causing the elongated top node and the expulsion cavities, which all the evidence indicates that's what's happening, the microwaves are heating up the moisture inside the plant stem, it seeps out at the top, which is how come they get stretched, it blows holes out in the lower part of the plant, because the stalk there is much tougher, it doesn't stretch. Well, if that's all true, which is what we believe is going on, these tractor lines would function and are, we're almost certain now after this last year's work, they would function as waveguides. These long, narrow, rectangular, you know, shapes, well, they're three-sided because the top, of course, is open, but this is an example of what is used as a waveguide when you're working with microwaves. And they are functioning, it appears, guiding the microwaves along the tractor lines, sometimes to a considerable extent away from the formation. And if this is all, this is theoretical, but if it's correct, it makes sense, because as the plasma is impacting the area where the circle is occurring, some of those microwaves are immediately dispersing and escaping. And the tram lines would function as perfect waveguides, taking the microwaves down and up away from the circle and affecting, therefore, some of the plants along the edges as it disperses.
So that's like a fringe element of the disbursement. It just happens to get caught there.
Yes. I mean, it probably has something to do with the amount of microwave energy, the intensity level of it, you know, and probably also the length of time that it's being deposited. I mean, if it's an instant, that would be a different amount of microwaves present in the field than if it lasts, say, a half a second or a second.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we also know from work that we did back in the 90s that in some formations, particularly some of the larger ones, we would find the plant and soil changes extending out into the standing crop in some of these cases, sometimes up to a point of almost 350 feet away. In other words, you wouldn't get a real control plant until you were at least 350 feet away from the downed crop area. Now, since the hoaxers claim that it's the flattening of the plants that produces all these changes, which is wrong, but that's what they say, how in the world then are they going to explain elongated nodes, expulsion cavities in standing crop that has never been flattened? And, you know, this again, we did find this last summer in this field where there were two of these formations, one right next to the other, bam, bam. And in that case, all of the standing crop in between the two was as affected as it was in the circles themselves. So those were the three things that were of interest to me mostly about this last report. The fact that the physical changes that are visible, meaning in some cases the seed heads are stunted and they haven't developed normally, when that is present, you won't see that the very first time you go, because it's something that occurs over several weeks. If that seed head is stunted and then you go and visit that circle, let's say 3-4 weeks after it occurred, and you compare the seed heads in the circle to the controls outside, sometimes you will notice that the seed heads are markedly underdeveloped. They haven't been killed. The plants are not dead, but the seed heads have stopped development at the moment that that crop circle occurred. And you can clearly see that in genuine circles when they occur fairly early in the season, and then you go back about a month later and compare the seed heads. So that's one visible sign that you can look for in a circle that happened several weeks before you're there.
Mm-hmm.
When you're there, you know, on the day it happens or the day after it happens, what you're looking for there are these elongated top nodes and or the presence of the expulsion cavities. And I remember very well in the early days when we first started doing this, we would see expulsion cavities not very often, and always when we did find them, they'd be in that second node beneath the seed head. And now we're finding them not just in the second node, but in the third and sometimes even the fourth. In other words, all of the nodes all the way down the plant stem.
Well, what counts for that?
I think what it means is an increase in the intensity of the discharge, that the microwave component is becoming increasingly strong, because the only thing, it's either that or it's lasting a little teeny bit longer, causing this internal moisture in the plant stem to turn to steam. Yeah, you know, the more microwaves you've got, or the higher they're cranked, I guess, the more likely it is to turn to steam very quickly without burning the plants. The plants are not burned, and people often, when they go to a crop circle that's been there for, let's say, 3 or 4 weeks in the field, and they find it, sometimes they'll see a black mark on, particularly around these holes, these expulsion cavities, mm-hmm. and they come to the conclusion that the plant is burned. Well, it's not. What it is it's a fungus. It's an opportunistic fungus that is carried through the air. It's called Eustalego, and it attaches itself, this, you know, when these holes are blown out, all the nutrients inside the plant's stem are open to the air, you see. And the fungus, these tiny little spores, attach themselves to that material, and as they replicate, they're black. And so as they replicate, you get this dark smudge in whatever area they've colonized. And an easy way to tell whether you're looking at Eustalego or you're looking at carbon, you know, as you would in something burned, is simply to take your hand and rub it across the area. If it's carbon, it's going to come off on your hands. I mean, you're going to get a carbon smudge.
Right.
You know, which you don't with the Eustalego.
But we do have a question. We've got a question in the chat room. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I don't want to let one go by. They want to know if more circles occur in the UK than anywhere else in the world, and if so, why?
Don't I wish I knew. It appears that part A of that question is, did most of them happen there? So far as we know, the answer to that's yes. At the moment and for the last 20 years, the greatest number that have been reported or found have been in the UK. As far as why, there are a couple things you want to take into consideration. One is that it is, to the very best of my knowledge, the strongest attempt to discredit the phenomenon by faking circles, you know, having people go out and make them. The greatest effort in that direction occurs in the UK. So a certain number of them in the UK every year, absolutely without question, are man-made. So that adds to the number overall, of course. Now, how many of them are man-made, nobody can tell you that, because nobody's ever tested all of the crop circles in the UK in even one summer. There are so many of them, and it's so expensive to do the work, nobody has ever been able to test every single circle, even in one summer in the UK. And so without doing that, you have no way of knowing what percentage is man-made and what percentage isn't. But it's well known that there are several active groups of people who make them in England.
Well, it's a shame that we don't have some government entity that, you know, goes around and looks at these all over the world and performs these tests, because Lord knows they're wasting money on things that aren't nearly as beneficial as this would be.
I think you're probably right. One of the discoveries, one of the major discoveries that we made during the 90s, I know is something that if it could be gotten out to the larger public and to governments in certain places in the world would make a massive difference. That was this business of when we found that when the crop circles occur in mature crop, you know, this is like mid-July to August, where that seed is fully formed and the plant is starting to dry down before harvest. When the crop circles happen then, those seeds will be dehydrated, they'll weigh less than the normals, and they look yucky, like they're not going to grow. But the fact of the matter is, they tend to grow at a much faster rate than normal control seeds. This is up to about 5 times the rate of normal in speed. They produce greater yield, in other words, more wheat or oats or barley or whatever, the kernels, and they do it without light or long periods of time. This immediately means that, A, you don't need anywhere near the amount of fertilizer to get that plant to full harvest. Number two, you don't have to worry about pesticides, because the pests are all, everything it's developed so that the pests occur at certain stages in the growth. Well, if the plant is growing much faster than normal, the pests are out of the race, you see. They come along at the wrong time, so you don't need the pesticides. And thirdly, if these plants can tolerate what the agricultural people call plant stressors, what they mean is not enough water and not enough light. If the plant can tolerate that for extended periods of time, then you could imagine that you could grow crop and get it to harvest in areas that are drought-ridden periodically, or where they're having trouble with not enough light. And we know that is one of the things that we found simply by studying the crop circles. Who knows what else there is still to be discovered if more scientists actually took an interest in this.
Then we could get serious about feeding the world. I mean, it's a simple way to bring seeds to these undernourished countries.
Exactly.
And it's just really sad that there's not a government latching on to that.
Well, Levin Good and John Burke, who died just a couple months ago, did work for many years on trying to replicate that change, you know, that we had found in the crop circles, And they discovered that by exposing perfectly normal everyday seed to what they called ion avalanches, these are electrically charged pulses, and it was simply a very simple machine where the seeds were placed on these long sheets, and then electrical pulses were sent through them, certain very specific types for very specific amounts of time. That's all you have to do to create the same thing in normal seed. If you do this, you get this result. They patented the process and built some of these machines and did treat many, many, many kinds of seeds, including cotton and corn, tomatoes, carrots, wheat, a whole variety of different seeds. And they were able in kind to determine, you know, exactly how much of a pulse, et cetera, to create this change. And then they would send this treated seed out to all of the major seed companies around the world. John spent several years traipsing around the world trying to get one of these seed companies to pick up on it, but nobody would. And he told me this repeatedly, that the fact that this then knocked out the need for fertilizers or as much fertilizer, that it also knocked out the need for pesticide. You know, many of these companies make their money that way.
Right.
That in his opinion...
It always goes back to money, doesn't it?
Doesn't it seem to?
Yeah. And for those listeners that don't know, John Burke was the B in BLT. And Nancy, I would like to say that I'm very sorry for your loss.
Oh, thank you so much. He was... It was quite unexpected. He had... had suffered from hepatitis for a long time, and his liver failed, and he went pretty quickly. But he was very interested in the circle phenomenon, and although John always approached it with the idea of finding a completely next explanation, meaning, you know, a scientifically based explanation, he was... Even though that was his basic interest, he listened to all sorts of other things that might make you reconsider that idea, you know? In other words, he wasn't stuck in a box.
Right. He had an open mind.
Yes, he did. And he wrote a book that was quite interesting called Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty, that is on the website. If you go to the published papers page, you will see description of what's in it. He went to various sort of ritual places and sacred places around the world with magnetometers and all sorts of other instruments, and was able to document the presence of unusual electromagnetic energies at these spots. And he had all sorts of ideas about what this meant, and he did experiments to demonstrate this, and many people find the book of great interest. So it's on the published papers page and easy to find on the BLT site.
Okay, let's remind the listeners that you can look at these photos and Nancy's report at bltresearch.com. It's UK 2009 crop studies. There's photos, there's pictures of control plants, as well as the plants taken from the circle.
You think I put enough pictures of blown nodes in there?
Well, I like that because you can really see the difference. That, gosh, there really is something going on there.
Well, I figure if you're going to do it, let's absolutely bury them in it. There must be 1,000 pictures in there. What we did was we took the samples and then we cut them up so we could get close-ups of the nodes. And you'll see in the pictures on the left will be the controls. On the right will be the samples, and you can use your eyes to see the difference. You don't even need to measure. Most of the cases we use for illustration were so dramatic that you don't even need to measure them. You can tell it with your eyes.
Yeah, it's very obvious. And I know that there's a point that you wanted to get out about young crop circles and older crop circles, since we're coming up on the time of crop circles beginning again this year.
Thank you very much for reminding me, because this is important. This has to do with node bending. in 50,000 crop circle movies and documentaries and things, you hear people running on about node bending, node bending, node bending, until I want to scream. Node bending can be significant in certain cases, and in others it doesn't mean a damn thing. And you need to know the difference. When you knock a plant over, as long as you don't kill it, I'm talking about cereal plants now, wheat, oats, barley, rye, stuff like that. If you don't kill it, if you don't mash it, it'll keep on growing. And if it's young and vigorously growing, it will begin to reorient itself to the sunlight, and that's called phototropism, and to gravity, and that, of course, is gravitropism. Those are two absolutely natural plant recovery processes if the plant is knocked down and not killed. So it happens pretty quickly in young plants. Within 3, 4, 5 days in young, vigorously growing crop, those plants are already starting to go right back to the sun. And so if you go to a crop circle, if you know that it just happened today, and you see that marked bending at any of the nodes within a day or two, then it's significant. It's something that happened when the crop circle was created. And planks and boards, by the way, don't do this. So if it's there right away in young crop, it means something. If you get to a circle a week or more after it occurred in young crop and you see node bending, you don't have a clue as to whether that's the recovery processes kicking in or whether it happened when the circle actually occurred itself. Now, in older crop, it's different. In the old, particularly if that crop is drying down, that crop does not have the energy. When you flatten it, it doesn't have the same kind of energy as the young crop does. And so node bending in the older and drier crop is significant. That's something that happened when the circle went down as it was swirled around in whatever direction it was. Another thing to look for when you see node bending is which direction are the nodes bent. Are they bending down? If you see them bending down, that's not gravitropism, that's not phototropism. That's something that happened when the circle was created. And the control studies that we have done repeatedly, a control study is where we took our feet or a cement roller in another case or a plank in another case and made tons of circles ourselves and then sampled them, you know, every couple of days throughout the summer. In those control studies, this does not happen. I mean, the natural recovery processes do, but you will not see the nodes bending down. You will not see the bent nodes in older crop, only in the young crop when it's doing these natural recovery processes. So you have to keep that in your mind. You have to know how long ago the circle happened and how vigorously growing were the plants when the circle went down to know whether node bending actually means anything or not.
So you've seen this misreported in some of the television shows and documentaries?
Yeah, it's all the time. There's this guy on the West Coast who I think he lives over there in England now, but he was a colorful character, and he decided to call them magical bends. Well, damn, don't you know that just flies through the media, magical bends. And for 10 years, all I heard on TV was about the magic bends. And I want to slit my throat, but what can you do?
Yeah. Well, did you ever try to contact him to educate him?
Oh, he knew. He liked the notoriety. I mean, he was enjoying, you know how the media, having been in the mainstream media yourself, you know that they look for sensationalism, catchy phrases, you know, sound bites, stuff like that. Well, what's better than magical bends when you're talking about crop circles? You know, the heck with the facts.
Yeah, you know, you're always looking for a headline that's going to draw the reader into the story. So,
I know.
Yeah.
And people, they don't, when they get it, they don't look any farther. A lot of times, they just don't look any farther. And it's like many, many things. You have to read I don't think, I actually think in almost any media, you read it and you use your own judgment, and then you read other sources, and you carefully pick a variety of sources to educate yourself about something that you're getting interested in, rather than taking, you know, all of your information from one place and deciding that that's what the facts are.
Right.
Even with science, the facts are changing often as people learn, you know, as the scientists learn something new.
For example, Pluto's not a planet.
And the world's not flat.
And
God knows so many other things.
We've got about 12 minutes left before the break, so you want
to
go...
I wanted to talk about one other thing, if I could.
Okay.
And it has to do with Jacques Vallée.
Okay.
As you probably know that name because he was a really well-respected UFO guy.
Mm-hmm.
He still is. He's alive. Although I don't think he's been real active lately. And recently, I don't know him. I know of him, and I've read a couple of his books, and I understand how well-respected he is, I believe, in most of the UFO community. But he's all of a sudden, for some reason I don't understand at all, taken to writing some things about crop circles. And I've seen a couple of these things that he's written lately about the crop circles. Now, he accepts the premise that microwave radiation is part of what's going on. I don't know if he accepts the entire plasma discharge idea or not, but he clearly does accept the idea that the plants are being affected by microwaves. I mean, I'm sure he's read our papers.
Do you know where we see the papers he's written?
Jacques Vallée, there is a blog, this is where I found it, called Boing Boing, BOING-BOING.
Huh.
I don't know what the hell it is, but that's what it's called, Boing Boing. And it's had two articles by him now about the crop circles and his idea. And I wanted to take the opportunity to comment, give my comments on his ideas, even though I've never met the guy.
Okay, great.
I think he's dead wrong. I'm real glad that he accepts the idea that microwave, you know, that's playing a role in all this, because that's certainly what the evidence tells us. But the parallel he draws from all of this is that it is a byproduct, or it is deliberate testing of microwave weaponry.
Oh.
That's what he's saying, he thinks, is how to understand what the crop circles are all about. Now, I mean, the guy's got a PhD, he's real intelligent, he's been around for a long time, and I don't want to sound rude here, but... Number one, crop circles have been around, we know for certain, since the early 1900s, and it appears that they've been around sporadically since the 16th century. So,
well, the thing about that is, if it were microwave weaponry...
Well, there wasn't any.
I've never known any military guys that have that much of a creative streak in coming up with those designs.
Well, I was getting there. My first point was there wasn't any in these historic times when we know crop circles happened.
Mm-hmm.
Number two was going to be that if you're testing microwave weaponry, I mean, it kills people, or it certainly would burn the hell out of them. And I don't think you'd be going around aiming these things if there are such weapons, which there might be, but I don't think you'd be testing them on fields where there are hundreds, literally, of tourists from countries all over the world hanging out in these fields in England at night, and they can be anywhere. They're not necessarily sitting on top of the hill. Half of them are out in the fields.
Well, true, but wouldn't you also accidentally fry some little bunny rabbits or something and find little burnt bodies?
You would think.
Oh, I don't think that's right either.
I mean, I don't think that makes much sense. And my third point was what you said, is that I'm not knocking the military. Thank God for the military. But the idea that these guys have nothing better to do than create and come up with all these wild designs, that doesn't make any sense to me at all. Now, I suppose Dr. Vallée may have some rebuttal to that, but those are some points that I came up with right away on reading it. And the other part of all this, Angela, that we haven't talked about, is this apparent evidence of a consciousness that is involved, a consciousness that is invisible and yet present in the fields. I have one of the stories, one of the reports that's in this thing I've just put up, concerns two colleagues of mine whom I know very well. Guys who are very skeptical, very cautious, very suspicious, you know, always looking for any sign that the thing is not the real McCoy. And they were having a conversation one afternoon walking along a farm track out in the middle of these fields, and they had been examining that phoenix, the one that I'm starting the whole report with. And it was so intricate, so pictorial, the lay inside of it was it was a very unusual lay, and they didn't know what in the world to make of it. They absolutely just were kind of boggled, you know, what in the world is this? And they were wishing that something more simple, like they used to be, would occur. And they specifically asked for sort of a multi-circled something that would have some part of it sticking out. And then they wanted some part of it that would look like a slice of pie or cake. And the two guys all by themselves out in the middle of this field, there's nobody else around. I don't believe there's any military listening devices out in the middle of these fields. And they're just casually, you know, commenting. They don't really think this is going to happen. They're just saying it would make their life easier if something like that would happen, because they'd know how to evaluate it. Well, the next day, in almost exactly the spot where they'd been standing, another circle, the Phoenix one, went down. Right where they had been. They had been examining the dragonfly, which was another one in that same field. Well, here comes the phoenix, right where they'd been standing. But it wasn't simple. It didn't have this circular design that they were asking for. They thought it was peculiar that it happened in the same spot where they'd been. But then the following day, in a different location, here comes this very sort of traditional crop circle down into the field, and it's a basically balanced, you know, geometric type design of the old-fashioned kind. But there's one section of the ring that sticks out, unlike the whole rest of the thing, and darned if there isn't this standing section of crop in the middle of that particular circle that looks exactly like a piece of pie or a slice of cake.
It does, and you need to go to bltresearch.com to see that photo. I was looking at it this afternoon, and you know, Nancy, we've talked about maybe these entities, if that's what you want to call them, creating them, have some kind of consciousness, but it almost seems like they were eavesdropping on those two guys' conversation.
And I know hundreds of stories exactly like that from totally reliable people who have spent huge amounts of time out in the field, and almost always people of a real skeptical bent to begin with, people who just cannot accept or having trouble accepting that the phenomenon is as unusual and peculiar as it is. And these things happen over and over again, often where a person is, they're driving along one of the roads and they see a pretty hillside and they think, man, that'd be a beautiful place for a crop circle. And the next day when they get out of their B&B and they're going along the same road, bam, right where they thought one would look great, there is one. Or they come up in their minds with a design of some kind and they don't tell anybody. Or they write it down on a piece of paper and they mail it to a friend, you know, so that it's on record. And they don't say anything to anybody. And bam, in the field, here comes the design. That happened to me once. And you cannot avoid after a while. I mean, the first couple times, in fact, maybe the first 10 times, you chalk it up to coincidence. Oh, that's a coincidence. Oh, I'm imagining that. But I tell you, after a while, it's more work to tell yourself it isn't real than it is to just go ahead and say, damn it, somebody was listening.
Well, I can see where it's more work to convince yourself that it was a coincidence. That's pretty funny. Listen, we're down to about 1 minute, and I just want to let everybody know you're listening to the Joiner Report on WPRN FM New Orleans and at UFOParanormalRadioNetwork.com. Looks like we've got a little bit of a light crowd in the PAL Talk room tonight, and let's see, we've got 38 people in PAL Talk. We're getting some good questions, and we're going to return with our guest, Nancy Talbot, for the second hour. We'll be back in about 8 minutes. Stay tuned.
D.C. Is the U.S. government withholding the truth about extraterrestrials engaging the human race? Could formal disclosure about extraterrestrials take place during the Obama administration? This and more will be covered at X Conference 2010 at the National Press Club, 2 blocks from the White House and 12 blocks from the Capitol. The conference will include lectures, an awards banquet, a speaker's cocktail party, and oh yes, a special luncheon presentation with yours truly. Come learn why, when it comes to UFOs, it's no longer just about lights in the sky. It's about lies on the ground. The National Press Club is just 2 blocks from Metro Center, and there are 24 hotels nearby. The event website, x-conference.com. That's x-conference.com, or call the Paradigm Research Group, 202-215-8344. That's 202-215-8344.
The Joiner Report. Now here's your host, Angela Joiner.
Hi, welcome back to the second hour of the Joiner Report at WPRN FM New Orleans and at UFOParanormalRadioNetwork.com. Tonight we've been speaking with Nancy Talbot about her phenomenal crop circle research. She's just completed a new report on the 2009 circles in the UK. And, of course, we're coming up on a new season for crop circles now. So she's been trying to point out some of the differences in what you see in young plants and mature plants. It's all really been quite interesting. And we've had quite a few questions come up in the chat room. Are you with us, Nancy?
Yeah, and I want to finish answering. I realize I dropped the ball on that other guy. I get so tickled talking to you, I forget what I'm doing. But the guy that asked about why so many in England, I've got another part of that answer that I forgot.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. The other important factor about southern England is that there's a chalk aquifer that underlies all of southern England. Chalk is the most porous rock in the world. And, you know, in the spring, you have a lot of rain. And as that surface water begins to percolate down through the chalk, electrons get stripped off the water molecules, and the ground electrical charge actually increases. And we know that this happens. We suspected it did, but John Burke and I did a lot of work, and then there were some other people that we hired that also did a lot more, taking ground electrical measurements in the areas where the crop circles occur throughout the summer, starting early in the season, then going right on through, through the end of August. And what we found was, in fact, that you got a slightly increased ground electrical charge as the summer went along. Well, if the hypothesis that a plasma discharge of some kind is what's causing the crop circles, it makes sense then that this change in the ground electrical charge, which is greater in southern England than in almost any other place we know, that would function, you see, as an attractor to such an atmospheric plasma.
Well, that is interesting. I didn't realize it was all chalk over there.
It is, and it's interesting that in many other parts of the world where we get crop circles a lot, there's frequently a limestone substrata And limestone is the next most porous rock.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you'd have a similar effect perhaps. But in England, we know that as the water table drops, because we've looked at all the records of the levels of the water tables, as it drops over the summer, which it does traditionally, this ground electrical charge does, in fact, go up a little bit. And, you know, so it fits with the idea that there is a plasma discharge of some kind causing the actual crop circles. So that may be another reason why we see so many there.
One of the questions comes from the chat room, and he wants you to discuss something that you and I discussed this afternoon while we were visiting. This is from Kai Truthseeker, and he would like for you to discuss the pi circle.
Oh, that thing was fascinating. That was last summer, it was 2008, at a place called Barbary Castle, and I don't have it in front of me, the details in front of me, but anybody who wants to see this in detail can find it at thecropcircleconnector.com. In the archives section, you go to 2008. It happened in June, and you simply scroll through the archives, and you'll get a. They do it blow by blow. But what happened there was that a mathematician recognized that there was a ratcheting effect that had occurred in this series of rings and circles. And it hit him, this was a guy with a lot of mathematical background, you know, geometry, that it in fact represented a number. And when he worked it out, he found that it in fact did represent the number for pi, the 3.1417, et cetera, et cetera. And it even included the decimal point. Now, I'm not a mathematician, and I can't explain it myself anywhere near as well as this guy does. He shows exactly how he derived that idea, step by step, and it will be in the archives at thecropcircleconnector.com. They charge a small amount to be allowed into the archives, which is where this information would be now, because, of course, they're on 2010. But you can find the entire discussion there.
Well, that's so interesting. And, you know, and one of the things I always wonder is, you know, if these circles are ET made, which it certainly appears that some of them must be, what are they?
It doesn't have to be ET. I mean, the problem with using the word ET is that people get a certain idea in their mind of what that means.
Okay.
It clearly indicates to many of us a consciousness, but there's a huge range of opinions about whether that might be interdimensional consciousness or the Earth's consciousness, the Gaia idea, you know, or the collective unconscious of humanity, or, there's a huge long range of ideas about the nature of the consciousness, not necessarily, and not even first, that it would necessarily be what you and I generally mean when we say ET.
Okay. Well, that's
I mean, who's right, I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, that's pretty deep for me, the Earth consciousness. I don't know. I don't know. But whatever it is, I always have to wonder, is what are they trying to communicate to us? I mean, to the point where they're giving us mathematical codes. What are they trying? What's it they trying to say? I don't know.
My best guess, be careful here. It is my best guess after paying attention to this for 20 years or whatever it's been. Number one, it is the most gentle, the least invasive way of enticing people, particularly people I think of an artistic nature or perhaps a musical background, architecture, that sort of thing, people who are drawn to artistic things, to recognize that we're not alone. A wonderfully gentle way of saying, hey, pay attention. Hey, wake up, wake up. Hey, look at this. and have people begin to consider this idea that humanity is not all alone in the universe. It's a lot less invasive or intrusive than a whole bunch of the other things that go on that may be indicators of the same thing. But whatever is behind the circle phenomenon seems to be interested in very gently introducing this idea. Secondly, some crop circles, maybe all of them, but I'd be more likely to suspect some of them, may also encode, just as that Barbary Castle pie formation did, they may also encode very precise information to someone who is very sophisticated, very well trained in a particular discipline. In the case of the Barbary Castle pie symbol, it was a mathematician. I think the guy was actually an astrophysicist who figured that one out. There have been cases where chemists have told me that something about the structure of a particular crop circle clued them into an answer to a problem that they had been working on for years in chemistry. There was another formation at a place called Crooked Soli, probably 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago now, which looked like strands of DNA, and a number of people who were experts in DNA analysis found that particular crop circle very informative. So it may be that some of the circles are not just the, hey, wake up and hi, you know, we're here, pay some attention to us. Some of them may be actually transmitting very precise information that you would have to have a background in that discipline to understand.
That would make sense. We have another. Here's another question. It scrolled by a while ago, so I've forgotten who asked it. But they want to know if you think the Crabtree Circle is authentic.
I don't have a final answer. My best guess is no. And the reason, I'm basing that on...
Oh, Crabwood, sorry.
Crabwood. They mean the alien face with the disc that was several years ago at Crabwood Farm. And it caused an enormous uproar, of course, in the crop circle community and lots of other people, too. But there were no physical changes, none of the visible changes in the plants in that case. We did do we did magnetic drags through it. We got no magnetic material, as we often do in crop circles. And also, it was reported regularly that that circle was made up. It was very differently made than many of them, and it was made up of many long lines of varying degrees of thinness. And it was reported that these were only, some of them were only 2 inches wide. Well, that simply is not true. The narrowest one of these lines was a good 5 inches wide at the base, which is plenty wide enough for a human foot. Uh-huh. The other reason I'm suspicious of it, as I also am of the so-called Arecibo reply, was there was a lot of breakage in these plants, which you get in older crop when they're man-made. But also, in both of those cases, the Crabwood Farm and the Arecibo reply, they occurred in locations where we don't watch. The people in England now don't watch every day. And so they could easily have taken several days to have been created before they were found, because they're in a location that simply is not flown over or checked with any regularity. But a full-fledged sampling effort was not carried out at either one, so I'll never know for certain. But I listen also to the various reports, because I'm in touch with a lot of people on the ground, the camera malfunction, that sort of thing, you know. And most interesting to me was the face that occurred next to the Arecibo reply, which very few people paid much attention to, and which I think, of the three, that was the one I think was probably the real McCoy. But I can't prove any of it, so your opinion's as good as mine.
Not really. You know, I really wish I could win the lottery or something and go out with you in one of these circles and learn from you, because I just think that would be such a fantastic experience.
Well, you'd learn. People go to them. It's good. I think it's useful to have these pointers that I've been, you know, trying to point out to people. But I think that the circle phenomenon is delighted to interact with individuals. You don't need me along. You can go, if you go in an open manner, you know, with your mind open to whatever this is, and, you know, keeping both sides of yourself, you know, open, and let yourself feel, I have a feeling that many, many people will learn what they need to learn without anybody telling them much of anything else at all, that you can pick it up on your own, the important stuff. The circles, the weird thing, of one of the weirdest things about them is this way they have of interacting, apparently, to people individually. And it happens over and over and over and over and over again. I mean, there are hundreds of people who, when I first heard these reports, I thought, ah, these people are crazy. I mean, I didn't pay any attention to it at all until it happened to me. And then I'm like, uh-oh.
Like, and was that an experience with your friend Robert in Holland?
No, it was before I met Robert. I got zapped big time in a circle at Overton, in Overton Road back in 92, I think it was, when I was still laughing at people who had these stories, you know. And I happened to have found a circle there one morning before anybody else had. And I walked very carefully through the tram lines to get up close to it. And I'm standing there, it's a long pictogram, and I'm looking at it, and I knew nobody had been in it, I could feel it, and it was so pretty, and I thought, oh, I can't go in that, I'll mess it up, you know, by walking on the plants, because it wasn't flat, it was in this real fluffy lay. And I stood there for 10 or 15 minutes just thinking, no, I shouldn't go in it. And then I said, well, you know, you came all this way and spent all this money, and the reason you're here, damn it, is to sample. And so I went in and just started to work. And after a while, some other people came, and I got them to help me too. And we worked for hours and hours and hours, and I don't know, around 1 or 2 in the afternoon, we were going to break and everybody go get something to eat. And I walked back to the car, I was walking back with my arms filled with all these samples, and two guys, whom I had never seen before, came walking in this little path that had been made up to the circle. And I have no idea why I said this, but I stopped them, and like God talking, I said, I want you guys to come back and park your car up on that hill facing the circle tonight, because there's going to be an addition. And then I marched off to my car with the samples and, you know, put them in and drove off to the barn. Well, these two guys are looking at me like, who in the hell was that? And, you know, why should I even listen? Well, I didn't know it, because I took the plants back to the barn. Then I went back to my B&B to clean up before lunch. And when I got to my room, I fell face forward on the bed and couldn't move anything. I could not move a thing. I couldn't move my fingers, my toes, nothing. And
wow.
I was like, uh-oh. Uh-oh, this is very bad. And I didn't know how long it was going to last, you know, and I'm lying there, and it's not changing. And I'm thinking, God, I'm going to die out here. And then I'm starting to think, well, gee, I wonder if they have ambulances. I mean, there are no hospitals out there, but maybe there'd be an ambulance. And then I realize, well, it doesn't make any difference, because I can't do anything to let anybody know I'm in trouble.
Right.
I mean, it's a B&B, and everybody's gone for the day, and I can't move anything to knock anything over. Well, short story, long story short, around 1:30, 2 o'clock the next afternoon, about 24 hours after, suddenly I can move. And I've had spent all of that time just focusing on breathing, because it felt like I couldn't breathe. It took everything I had just to breathe. And suddenly,
that must have been so frightening.
It was, but I couldn't do a thing about it, you know? I remember thinking, well, you know, I wonder how long it's going to take for my family to know I'm dead. I wonder how long it's going to take for anybody to know. Thinking some awful thoughts about that, you know. But at any rate, suddenly I can get up, and I went right into the John and got myself cleaned up and everything. And I went right back to this field because I was real curious to find out if anybody else had had the same kind of effect, you know, because I didn't know what it was, but I was okay. I get back to the field, and there's a group of people out in the same crop circle, and they have apparently just arrived. And what had happened was these two guys, whom I later got to know, had come back that night. They had parked their car up on the hill, facing down toward this crop circle, because it was down sort of in a gully. And in the middle of the night, around 2:30 a.m., they had seen what they described as a white mist, like just like a fog, kind of, come in over the fields, which is not really all that unusual, you know, in low-lying fields in the middle of the night. But this is what they told me. They said it took on the form of a horse, galloped right smack across the formation, and disappeared into this long barrow, which is one of these ancient burial places, on the other side of the field. And that happens to be the only long barrow that's not been excavated. It's one that they've left deliberately, you know, unexcavated. And it scared these guys so bad that they started the car up, and they were afraid to drive forward because it would have taken them closer to the circle. So they backed down like a 90-degree hill into this little village of Overton, and then turned the car around when they got into Overton and went the long way around to get back to their B&B. Well, it turns out they've convinced a bunch of people to come with them because they want to see what's happened, and they were afraid to go in the thing earlier. So they've come back with a group of people. And they had gotten there apparently just a few minutes before I arrived, and found that there was, in fact, another circle that had been added at the far end of the formation, and it had a standing center. And they were all in the thing, looking at this new circle, and while they were standing right there, this center tuff just turned around on itself and went down. Boom.
Ah!
And this had just occurred as I drove up. So they're telling me, you know, yakety yakety yakking about how they, you know, the guys came back, this is what they saw, the new circle has come. And I'm thinking, how in the world did I know that? Because I don't know how I knew that. I have no idea why I spoke to those guys that way. And then once they had calmed down a little bit about what they've just seen, I'm trying to find out if anybody else had this breathing problem. And nobody did. Just me.
And so did you feel strange when you told them that there would, did you have any kind of feeling like,
no,
my God, where did that
like God, I'm just, you know, you guys come back and park your car. I'm telling you, I'm the oldest of four children, and maybe this is where it comes from. But I was telling them just like I'd have told my brothers and sisters, you know, you do this and you do that. I've never seen these guys before.
And then when you were able to move and breathe regularly after 24 hours, did you feel your energy was drained? Did you feel sickly?
I felt fine. I felt like maybe I was losing my mind, but I felt fine. And the way I interpreted all of this eventually, because I had heard many stories, not exactly like that, but other stories that people had told, was that number one, you know, I was being an arrogant idiot in judging these other people because clearly something weird was going on. And secondly, I remembered very clearly that I had had this hesitation about going in on that very first morning. And I think that the energies that were involved in making that crop circle, some of them were apparently still present, or maybe they all were. And something about that energetic situation was not good for me. And my instinct was warning me, was telling me, don't go in. And it was my, I think it's my super ego or my id, I don't know what, but you know, the part of you that tells you what you ought to do, took over and said, look, idiot, go on in and quit being romantic about this, go on in and do the work. And if I had paid attention and not gone in, I'll bet you I wouldn't have had that reaction. But I was the only one. All the other people who had arrived and helped me, none of them had the same response. But we know from Lucy Pringle's work in England that people in any one given crop circle may have a variety of effects or no effect at all. This happened last summer with Robert. You know, there was a formation at Zevenbergen where it was, my legs were burning so badly I had to leave the field. A couple of the other people who were there had no response at all, and others had a different response from the one I was having.
That is weird.
It is.
Okay. We have about 22 minutes left, I think.
Okay.
So just letting you know that. And you want to go ahead and talk about your Travis Walton investigation now, or?
Sure. Everybody knows the Travis Walton case, of course. And I was a latecomer to his case. I mean, a lot of people knew about it long before I did because my interest was the crop circles. But I heard about it at some point, and I don't remember how the original contact actually occurred. I really cannot remember. It's in my file somehow. But somehow or other, Mike Rogers, the guy who was driving the truck the night that whole thing happened, and I got in touch with each other. And Mike was, at least at that time, still working up in those forests, you know. And we already, by this time, knew about a number of these changes in the plants in the crop circle situation. And we were wondering whether or not a similar type of energy might be registered in the trees around the Walton incident, you know, where that took place.
Right, you've been studying plants, and you know that changes have occurred.
Exactly. And we have some idea. At that point, we had some idea that, number one, there was this microwave component. Number two, there were these electrical pulses. Number three, there were these strong magnetic fields. And we knew that they had an effect on the plants and wondered whether, I mean, we have never had the feeling that UFOs make crop circles. We don't know whether they do or not. It's, for us, a wide open question. Maybe they do, maybe they don't, maybe they make some of them, you know. But at any rate, the UFO thing seems to also involve unusual energetics. And so we had this question about whether there might be some way of looking for evidence of an effect on the trees surrounding that clearing where Travis got picked up. And Mike and I were discussing this, and it turns out that that's an area that is owned by, I can't remember what they call, the National Forestry Service. It's owned by the government, you know, by the people of the United States, and you can't just go in there and be messing around without permission.
Mm-hmm.
And since Levengood is a legitimate scientist, and he was the one who would be doing the work, I wanted to make sure that I got all the permissions, because what we had decided to do was to take cores of the trees immediately surrounding that clearing and then moving, say, 5, 10, 15 feet away and doing all the trees at that distance and continuing that at, you know, to a considerable distance away from the clearing itself.
That would give you the controls.
Exactly. That's what we wanted to see if we could find any. And Mike, of course, knew exactly where it was. And so I started to work with the Forestry Service to get the necessary permits to let us go in there and do this coring. And he kind of didn't feel, I guess he decided he just didn't want to wait. I was getting somewhere, but it takes a while, you know. And he jumped the gun and went in there. I had explained to him how we would do it once we got the permission, which I probably shouldn't have done until we got the permission. But anyhow, he jumped the gun and went up there by himself and did it and produced all of these core samples of the trees from right around the edges of that clearing, moving farther and farther and farther away. And Levengood went ahead, and we couldn't write a report about it because all the coring had been done illegally, you see.
Right.
But he couldn't stand not to look at the cores, so of course he did. And in these tree rings, when you do a core sample, you see a difference in, you know, each year the tree adds another ring, and those tree, the rings vary in their width, dependent upon many things. You know, how much water they've had, how much sunlight they've gotten, a whole bunch of things affected. But what we found in the same species, and I didn't get the report out of the file because I don't have the species here in front of me, but in the same species, which is what we looked at in every case, the ones that were closest to the event, the incident itself,
the pickup spot,
the clearing, the edges of the clearing, showed a dramatic change in width of the ring itself. And this was in every single one of the trees right around the clearing, and then it dropped off as a function of distance as we cored farther and farther away from that clearing. Now, we also looked at the area from the standpoint of were there areas where there might be collections of water, you know, little pools of water where the trees would get better nourishment. Was there any other kind of thing we could see that would have influenced these rings? And we couldn't see any other factor other than knowing that in 1975, you know, Travis had this incident occur in that clearing. And there is, I've still got that stuff, and I think I may be able to put it out now. It's been long enough that maybe it's okay to do it and let everybody see. It's clear as a bell that those trees directly around that clearing were absolutely affected by something electromagnetic.
And what year were you looking at this?
About 1995, I think.
Mm-hmm. So you could go back through the circles in those cores all the way back to...
I've got all of that stuff in the files. There are an awful lot of work that we've done that's never been put out for one stupid reason or another, but we've done a fair amount of stuff on UFOs, and I'm getting close to being able to put out some of that, organize it. It's in huge boxes, and it's all labeled, so I know where it is. But we had some beautiful photographs of these cores, and you could just sit there yourself, you know, and count the years back. We knew what year we took the core sample, and then you simply count back to 1975, which you can do on all of them because they're good, clear, close-up photos, and it's quite obvious that 1975, something unusual happened to those trees.
I think that is so interesting, and it's something that's not been talked about before. Did Travis ever know this information?
I don't know, because I think that he and Mike maybe were not talking back then, or were not real close or something. I mm-hmm. think I did talk to Travis myself a couple times about it, and he didn't want to go back up there, and God knows I wouldn't blame him. Travis, I don't think you'd ever get me back anywhere near that area. And so it was Mike that, you know, I ended up working with, and I don't know if Mike, I don't even know now whether the two of them talk or get together and share information. I really don't know.
I know I interviewed Travis Walton back in the fall of last year, I think it was. And I do think there was some sort of hardship about Mike being the driver and, you know, leaving with the other guys. And, I'm not sure.
I can see how both of them would feel. You know, if I were Travis, I'd want to kill Mike, but if I was Mike, I'm sure I'd have felt like getting the hell out of there. What a horrible situation, you know, for everybody.
Yeah, it really was. And I think Travis is one of the best cases that I know of. I mean, he obviously was missing for several days. Nobody could find him. His family didn't know where he was. I mean, where was he? I mean, I just don't think he made that up.
I don't think he made it up either. You know, it's I don't know anywhere near as much about the UFO phenomenon as many people out there, but I've read a fair amount, and I think I have come to, it's more my notion that there are probably multiple unknown entities, consciousnesses, beings, whatever you might want to call them. I remember Constant Trevor or Trevor Constable's sky critters, these blobs that he'd pick up when he took infrared photos that he thought of as indigenous, living, indigenous, invisible creatures that lived right here that we just didn't know about. What happened, the sort of thing that happened to Travis and has happened to apparently a number of other people, doesn't seem to me to jive at all with the basic, everything that I know about the crop circle phenomenon, which does also appear to have a consciousness of some kind involved. So where it takes me is either you got, maybe these creatures are menopausal or something, and one day they're one way and one day they're the next, or more likely what you've got is multiple different consciousnesses or awarenesses or intelligences, and maybe they're not all physical either.
Well, you know, you've told me before, I think it was the last time you were on, that you feel like there is some sort of combination of paranormal, UFO, spiritual, spirit things that's all kind of wrapped up together.
I have a feeling that all of these things are bits and pieces of the same major unknown thing, something that we, the humans, and maybe humans are not supposed to know, I'm not sure, but that what goes on, when you look at the mess that we make of everything on Earth, you know, that we can see, and good Lord knows we have, you know, everywhere you look, there's some horrible mess. That, you know, how is it, the reason that we don't see all this other stuff, maybe it's good is what I'm saying, that we have trouble enough with what we can see and what's right here in front of our faces to deal with. But I've seen too much now to think, I know there's more than what we see, and there's and it's conscious and it's aware, and there may be many it's, and they may, each one of them may have very different agendas. I also wonder, Angela, about how much each of our human thoughts, how much each one of us human beings has to do with the existence of some of these other things, that our very thoughts, our very ideas may in fact generate somehow some of this stuff, which is not to say that I think people are crazy when they report seeing strange things. Maybe some people are, but a lot of people aren't. And it's a very, whatever this is, it's very complex. It's not a simple answer. And most everybody wants a simple answer. They want to be able to understand it, put it in a pigeonhole somewhere, and then figure out how to restructure their life around it. And I don't see that happening.
Do you think governments know what's going on, or do you think they're just as lost as we are?
Well, if I could learn what I've learned in these 20 years, they've got to know a lot more than I do. I mean, I have no special talent. I have no special access to anything. I'm just a normal, well, some people might argue that, but, you know, I'm a regular person who's gone out there and just been curious. And if I could see and learn as much as I have seen and learned with no more help than that, then of course the governments have got to know more than I do. And my guess is that if all of this is ever better understood, one of the major changes that's going to happen among humans is that we will, through this, we will learn about our own power, about powers and strengths and abilities in humans.
Do you mean like developing our sixth sense?
Yeah, all sorts of psychic. I mean, I personally can easily imagine that it's possible that humans will learn, if we don't blow ourselves up or pollute ourselves to death, you know, that we're going to learn how to communicate telepathically, like every day. No big deal. I think there are many things like that, many capabilities like that that we, that humans have, that if we learn how to develop them, will make us much less dependent on the power structure as it exists now, you see. And therefore, anybody who is benefiting from the power structure as it exists now might not want us to learn those things.
Yeah, they're going to be fighting that because, like we said before, it always comes back to money.
It might very well.
But, you know, maybe there will be a world where money is not the focus anymore. God, I would like to see that.
Well, you know, abrupt change, we humans do not do that well. Abrupt change is scarce. And I remember the very first time I was in England, and I had been hearing all these stories from the Brits. Actually, George Wingfield telling me a bunch of his adventures and other people. And they were all talking about E.T., the possibility of E.T.s. And since I had had that encounter when I was a kid that scared me badly, I was not even vaguely interested in hearing about E.T.s. It wasn't the vibe I got from crop circles anyhow, but I wasn't interested in that point of view. And they were telling me about some funny lights they'd seen and strange noises and everything. And I remember going into this field in Alton Barnes, and it was late afternoon, and all the Brits, everybody was off at tea, so I was by myself. And I stepped into the circle, which had been there for quite a while, and immediately felt, the only way I can describe it is a presence, like somebody or something invisible standing right there next to me. And I registered that it was there, and then I thought, okay, again, I've come all this distance, I've spent all this money, damn it, I'm going to see this crop circle. And so I said out loud, I don't want any funny lights, I don't want any funny noises, I scare real easy, you know, I want to go through and look at this crop circle, so don't do any of that stuff. And then I forced myself to go through the whole thing with whatever this thing was that I could feel right there, but it didn't make any funny noises. There was no funny lights. I was able to go through the whole thing and examine the plants and, you know, really pay attention. It took a lot of guts, frankly, because I was all by myself and I was scared. But I came out of the thing, and what I learned, not only from that experience, but from many, many things that have happened since, a lot of them with Robert in Holland, that whatever it is that's around the crop circles seems to respect your needs, particularly if you go ahead and say, at least in my case, I make it real plain, what it is I think I can handle and what it is I think I can't. Because, you know, I know that certain things would scare me so much that I probably would turn blue.
Well, it didn't really seem to respect your needs when it left you paralyzed and you had difficulty breathing.
I didn't ask for anything that time.
Oh.
I was getting a very clear vibe not to go in that circle. I mean, it was clear. It was just I didn't understand that there wasn't it. I didn't believe in any of that then. You know, I thought that was ridiculous. And so I chalked that whole feeling up to a romantic notion on my part, you know, silliness. Never occurred to me that there really could be some invisible something there. It was the last thing in my mind. And now, you know, I've seen enough stuff so that I've changed my mind. I mean, I'm sure there are people out there who don't agree with me, but I know what I think, and I know why I think it, And I know that when I go to a crop circle, even now, all these years after, I always come up to it, and I do this whether I'm with Robert or whether I'm on my own or whether I'm doing field work, and I stand outside it for just a few, you know, a minute or so to see how it feels. And mm-hmm. if I feel the need, I say, is it okay if I go in to the air? And if I don't get any feeling that tells me no, then I go on in. And it's never happened since.
That's very interesting. It's just, it's almost like, you know, you're able to communicate and without understanding how, really.
Oh, in that case, it's, I mean, it's probably telepathy rather than whatever it is understands English, but what I know from these events with Robert, where over and over and over, I mean, dozens and dozens of times now, and I'm going to write a report up on this eventually, the something that a question I have just asked, and then bam, whatever I've just asked, not even meaning that I expected to see it, the answer comes on the camera, you know, with Robert using his camera. Or I told you about the time that we're sitting out in the field talking about blue and aquamarine and what happens, but immediately 30, 40 shots of this fabulous, beautiful light thing, all blue and aquamarine happen. Or I ask him about his this guardian angel type thing that he used to see and would tell me about. And one day we were driving to a field in the middle of the afternoon, and it occurred to me I hadn't heard him talk about her for a while because she had a name. And so I asked him if he still saw Doya. And he said, well, actually, he hadn't seen her for a while. And then we went on and talked about other things. Got to the field, which didn't have a crop circle in it at the time. It was a place where we'd gotten some other really wild photos. And walked into the field, the two of us, and he suddenly tells me he feels this energy present. I can't remember what he used the word energy that time. Or
we've got about 30 seconds. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, he, you know, asked for my camera. I hand it to him, stand right there while he does it. Bing, bing, bing. He takes three shots right in a row, and there's Doya. Now, I don't know, but there's a number of these things. They keep happening, and at some point, you really are working harder at denying what's going on than, you know, sometimes you just have to get real, you know?
Nancy, I've really enjoyed talking with you tonight. And if you would, give Robert a hello and a hug for me, I would appreciate that. And I think next week I am going to have Paula Harris on, and we're going to be talking about the book Rachel's Eyes. It's the author, one of the authors. It was Yeah, and Helen Littrell or Littrell, I'm not sure. And Paula's real into that story, and she really would like to get the word out there and let people know about it a little bit more. It actually occurred about 40 years ago, I think, but it involves what they think was a hybrid girl. And
story.
Yeah, it really does seem like an interesting one. So next week we'll have Paula Harris, I think, and we're trying to work out the details of that now. And I do appreciate everyone in the Pal Talk chat room. I love seeing my Open Minds forum buddies, and I appreciate all the listeners. I really do. You've been listening to the Joyner Report on UFO Paranormal Radio Network.com and at WPRN FM New Orleans. Thanks for being with us tonight. Good night.
Good night.